Du lytter til Radio 24/7.
Danmarks nyheds- og debatradio.
Hør os live eller on demand på radio247.dk. Velkommen til Aflyttet med Anders Kjærulf.
Velkommen til Aflyttet, programmet, der i anledning af sommeren nu er iført skæg og solbriller, og som i dag byder velkommen til det første af i alt fire sommerremix-programmer, hvor vi sætter ældre indslag herfra sammen, så de får nye perspektiver, måske. I den her udgave der har jeg samlet op på meget af det, vi har sendt om den amerikanske overvågning via National Security Agency, NSA. Men vi starter et helt andet og tilsyneladende fredeligere sted, nemlig på Facebook. Det her sociale netværk, vi næsten alle sammen kender, og som kender os langt bedre, end vi kan forestille os. For selvom vi sletter oplysninger eller lader dem være skjulte, ja, så beholder firmaet bag de oplysninger i en såkaldt skyggeprofil. Her sidst i juni måned kom Facebook til at lægge over 6 millioner profiler, der pludselig stod pivåbne. Og når de ramte, dem der havde profilerne, studerede indholdet af Facebooks læk, ja, så viste det sig som end, at ikke nok med, at oplysninger brugerne selv havde slettet, stadigvæk var der, men Facebook havde også hugget eventuelt manglende oplysninger fra andre profiler, der var i kontakt med brugeren, for eksempel arbejdsmailadresser og den slags. Facebooks plan bag det hele er angiveligt at skabe en perfekt profil til marketing, men måske har det også et andet formål. En af dem, der har tidligt bestemt sig til at undersøge, hvad Facebook egentlig gemmer om os, det er østrigske Max Schrems.
And I noticed your phone, you got it in 900. Are you still?
I love it, but it's breaking up now. It's like this? The plug here. It's like it's one of these things that are meant to break, and it's already broken a second time. Now I gotta get a new one, which is kind of stupid. I love it actually. Yeah. And I want to have a new cell phone with like a full keypad as well, which they hardly produce anymore, so it's a shame.
There's not many of them left. No.
Anyways.
Yeah.
Max Schrems kan bedst i telefoner med tastaturer. Hans yndlingsmodel er Nokia N900, den sidste, der kom med open source software, før finnerne overgav sig til Microsoft. Max er i godt humør. Han har lige modtaget den amerikanske borgerrettighedsorganisation Epics Privacy Champion Award, og så har den 26-årige østriger lige bestået sin juraeksamen for et par uger siden. Hans hår stritter til alle sider, øjnene lyser, og han emmer af ungdom og mod på livet. Men der er andre ude i verden, han har gjort livet surt for. Eller retter et firma, Facebook.
I was studying in the US for half a year, and there I was writing a paper on Facebook, and you have like solid evidence because there's so many rumors about Facebook. We made access requests just to get a copy of all the data. And in my case, I got 1,222 pages, but you got to say that I hardly ever, I mean, I post something like once a week or so. I'm not like a heavy user. The funny thing, though, was that all the deleted stuff was in there as well. And you got like all the deleted data again they shouldn't have. So what we did is we published it on one site so that people know what Facebook is actually doing to kind of get rid of all the rumors. But we also filed 22 complaints at the Irish Data Protection Commissioner. Ireland is responsible because Facebook has its international operations in Ireland for all operations outside of the US and Canada. For tax reasons, they just pay about 2% tax there. And that was kind of the funny thing that in this case, first time around, a real user was claiming his rights to data protection.
Max Schrems er blevet verdenskendt som manden, der har krævet sin ret over for Facebook. Og hvis ene eksempel kan vise sig for en over meget store konsekvenser for verdensfirmaet, der i øjeblikket dækker 92% af hele verdens forbrug af sociale medier, og som har over en milliard brugere verden over. Mens Max studerede på Santa Clara Universitetet i Silicon Valley, der kom Facebooks privacy-advokat Ed Palmieri på besøg, og Schrems var ikke imponeret over hans indsigt i europæisk databeskyttelseslovgivning. Og så fik Max en idé. Han ville vide, hvad Facebook egentlig vidste om ham. I første omgang kom der kun et par sider, men Max gav ikke op og bad om det hele. Det hele viste sig at være over 1.200 tætskrevne sider, der blandt andet indeholdt chatbeskeder, oplysninger om, hvem han havde unfriended, og alle hans private beskeder, inklusive dem, han selv aktivt havde slettet.
And that kind of triggered a whole case that's still ongoing where right now in like the it's like 1.5 years now that the whole thing is running. And we hopefully get a final decision in the next couple of months. It's just very likely that the Irish DPC will more lean towards Facebook. They're very, very kind of anti-privacy and very company friendly. And we're currently planning to also appeal whatever the DPC is deciding if it's not in line with European Union law. A lot of the other European data protection authorities also indicated that they are not thinking that the Irish are in line with the law. And there are certain rumors that Ireland wants to protect Facebook for financial reasons or economic reasons. We don't have any evidence of that so far. But it's kind of interesting that maybe also for cultural reasons, they're just not really enforcing the law. As well, if you talk with them directly, they're like, yeah, there is like informed consent under the law, but we don't really think that's right, so we just didn't enforce that. And that's the stuff where you're like, what? We were like in the European Union, there are like basic principles and you got to stick to it, because we also defend like an Irish person and comes to Austria. And I would expect the same thing the other way around, but currently we just don't see that.
Max Schrems klagede over Facebooks registreringer af ham, som han mener er i direkte modstrid med de europæiske databeskyttelseslove. Samtidig mente han ikke, at Facebook havde udleveret alle data om ham. Blandt andet kunne han ikke få sine egne ansigtsgenkendelsesdata udleveret, dem som Facebook har brugt til at genkende folk til tagging. Facebook hævdede, at de data var en forretningshemmelighed, og der er kun ét sted at klage, Irland, hvor Facebook har sit europæiske hovedkvarter. Det er det samme sted som Google og Apple bor, for at undgå at betale skat af penge, de tjener her. I Europa har man generelt ret til at få alle oplysninger udleveret fra firmaer, der gemmer dem om en. Og den ret benyttede Max Schrems sig af. Samtidig postede han hele sin datafil fra Facebook på sit site Europe vs. Facebook og startede på den måde en bølge af ansøgninger om at få udleveret data. Over 40.000 mennesker har forsøgt det samme, som han har nu. Men Facebook har lært lektien. Ingen har fået så mange data ud af tjenesten som Max.
There are 22 complaints with very different issues. For a lot of them, it's just like, for example, you deleted something and it's not gone. Another thing is the access requests, where after 1.5 years, I still didn't get all of my data. And that's really basic privacy law issues where we hope that they stick to. Overall, you could summarize it in one side is transparency. So Facebook should tell the people what they actually do with the data so they can make an informed consent. And I don't have any sympathy, I gotta say, for someone that posts their naked pictures on Facebook. But if you post a normal picture and Facebook is doing weird stuff with it that no one expects, I think people should be informed. That's kind of the transparency thing. The other thing is the control issue, so that if you post something or delete something, if you set privacy settings to a certain setting, they should actually work that way. And we picked out individual buttons, individual issues to kind of make these two points clear.
Irlands datatilsyn er tungt at danse med. Max Schrems klager er blevet skubbet rundt i systemet så længe, at flere mener, at Irland rent faktisk forsøger at beskytte Facebook, der har mange arbejdspladser i landet. Max Schrems har stadig ikke fået alle sine data udleveret, og en række af de 22 klagepunkter, han har fremlagt, er nu, over et år senere, stadig ikke behandlet. Max Schrems er nu i gang med at forberede en stor sag mod både Facebook og det irske datatilsyn ved EU-domstolen for at tvinge dem til at overholde EU's datalovgivning.
The big problem we run into right now is if we go to courts, it costs a lot. So far it was for free, but if we appeal the DPC's decision, we look at costs of 100,000 to 300,000 euro, which is way too much for me. And that's the reason why we set up an NGO where we try to get donations as well to kind of get that through. What would be really interesting and what's the aim is to get the stuff before the European Court of Justice, because many of the questions we raised have never been really fully answered, but it's very clear how they will be answered. And it would be really cool to get like highest court rulings on these issues, because it would also kind of send a signal into the industry that actually if you break European law, there could something happening to you as well. Because when I was studying in California, the general answer to European data protection was like, yeah, but you can do whatever you want to do and nothing ever happens. And that was kind of the thing where it's very easy to bash American companies, but actually we have to look inside of Europe how we fix the problem to make them comply with the law.
So we're not hard enough on them?
No, we're not. I mean, we do have privacy laws and we put them in place. But we're not really enforcing them. They exist on paper. Like, for example, in Austria, my home country, maximum penalty is 20,000 euro. 20,000 euro is nothing for Facebook. It's just laugh about that. And that's really the thing where we got to go forward. And that's the reason also why I do like the proposal by the commission a whole lot, because they really have this, they keep the good old data protection law and the good old principles that I think are still right today. But they add onto it serious enforcement and serious cooperation. And today it doesn't really help if you have a national law, but if we have wonderful laws in Austria, it doesn't help me if they're not enforced in Ireland. That's the reason why I think also the idea of having a one-size-fits-all regulation just makes sense. It's just going to be really interesting if it's not like watered down and diluted by different lobbying agencies that do everything they can to get rid of this regulation.
Data mining og big data er en del af selve sagen. Schrems fandt nemlig ud af, at der ligger lister over ting, som Facebook mener, han burde være interesseret i. På den liste lå blandt andet en ekstrem højrefløjspolitiker, som han på ingen måde kan lide. Og så var der alt det, som Facebook gemmer uden at fortælle noget om det. For eksempel trækker Facebook data ud af dine venners mobiltelefoner via diverse apps og samkører dem med dig. Schrems opdagede flere kendte e-mailadresser af de data, han fik udleveret, adresser han aldrig selv har opgivet til Facebook.
Actually, I don't find anything disturbing anymore. If you do data protection for a while, there's very, very little that really disturbs you anymore, because you just use that, no one really sticks to it. But what was really interesting, as an example, was last location. There is a data category that's called last location, where they have the GPS coordinates where they think you've been the last time. I've never put any geolocation into Facebook. I've never said I'm here or there or checked into places. But still, there was the GPS location was my university in the US at that time. And there are other things like, for example, deleted friends, where you have a list of all the deleted friends again. And other data categories like also friend requests. So people you don't want to be friend on Facebook. Facebook is storing that you don't want to be friends with them. Another thing that was interesting was all the metadata that's attached to, let's say, a picture that you upload. They also, for a while now, they started reading all the metadata out of your picture. So which camera model are you using? If there's GPS data attached to it, where you have taken the picture. And if you, for example, upload such a picture from an iPhone or so, and you tag 10 people, Facebook knows that these 10 people have been at this and that exact location at this and that time. And that's all stuff that happens in the background and users don't really know about it.
You also said you were being associated to a politician that you didn't know and didn't like.
Yeah, that was one of the more recent data things where suddenly they have keywords where they think you're interested in for advertisement, and there were like random keywords where it was like, no, I'm so not interested in that person. But you hardly ever know why Facebook gets to that. It's also interesting for the whole profiling thing, because suddenly you see or don't see certain things just because Facebook thinks you're interested in one or the other thing. And in reality, you don't have any possibility to check that or say, I don't want that. Or it's this whole kind of filter bubble discussion that happens there as well. And that's oftentimes the problem with Facebook, that they are under the law, they have to tell you where to get that from. But in fact, they're just saying, no, we don't tell you.
Og så handler det hele i sidste instans om et centralt spørgsmål. Hvem ejer dine data? Facebook mener tydeligvis, det er dem, der gør det. Men sådan ser Max Schrems og Europa i det hele taget ikke på det.
One of the new things about them is a new graph, the new search part. How do you think that will make new things to think about for you at least?
There were a couple of good articles recently on the graph search where they really tried to, I don't know, graph search people that indicated they're gay and living and working at, I don't know, a ministry or something, and they could actually find people that way. When Zuckerberg introduced it was like it's about people sharing more and being more open. I think the reaction is going to be that people are going to be even more scared to put anything in and going to be more restricted on their privacy settings. The big problem, though, is that there are so many bits of information on Facebook, and you have to adjust the privacy settings for every individual bit. So that people are just going to be unable to cope with it. And we see kind of a tendency, in Germany you call it the salami tactic. You cut a little piece by piece so people never feel that it's all kind of public now. And we had that with Timeline, where suddenly all the old stuff that was long gone is popped up again. And now you have all this old stuff that popped up, and now it's really easy to search again. Because it used to be that you had to scroll like a timeline for hours to really find something. And it's getting more and more and more transparent bit by bit by bit. And I'm questioning if people actually want that. I personally don't care for it. I delete all my old postings right after, like after a week or so. But the problem is that Facebook doesn't really give you the tools to do that. Like with any normal service, I can, for example, delete everything or click on delete everything but these five pieces or so. On Facebook, it's really done the way that you have to click on every individual bit to change the setting on every individual bit, and you just give up after the fifth thing. And I think there's like a certain tactics of having an opt-out system and making it super hard for everybody to opt out. And under the law, you would actually have to have an opt-in system, but Facebook is currently more or less ignoring that.
Trimps kamp mod Facebooks datapolitik har allerede haft konsekvenser. Facebook siger nu, at de ikke vil bruge ansigtsgenkendelsessoftware i EU, og med sidste opgradering af deres privacypolitik har de da også lukket et par huller. Men der er langt endnu, før Trimps er tilfreds. Og han håber i den grad, at EU's kommende persondatalov kan være med til at rette op på tingene.
And one thing for Facebook that you got to mind is Facebook, in fact, is just a little blue bar, and everything below that is not done by Facebook but by the users. So the biggest value we give them is the content, because without our content that we push into that system, it would be a white page that no one would visit. And now you have advertisement on the side, and that works quite well, and you can now push it for a couple of percents just by doing it more personalized. And the question is, if we already give all our content to them, which is something that we pay, if we also give the data to them, how deep should the analyzing be, and how much should they keep? Can they still do reasonable? Can they still make a reasonable living and a reasonable amount of money, which they have to do, by just not going all that deep, by not keeping all the deleted data, by not kind of rejecting all your rights? And I do think they can. They just don't want to.
Men hvorfor bruger en ung mand så meget tid på noget, han jo bare kunne melde sig ud af? Og hvorfor har han egentlig stadig en Facebook-konto?
I still use Facebook because I think it's kind of a childish argument, but I think it's still right. It's not us making it wrong, it's them. So I don't think that we have to change, but I think they have to change. There's also not really a possibility to log off, because Facebook is one case, but to me Facebook is just like one typical example of a whole industry. And if you don't want to be tracked, you are not allowed to use Google, don't have an iPhone, don't lose Facebook, and kind of get back to having a TV and a landline phone. And that can't really be the solution. It's not that we should censor ourselves, but that we should ensure that they stick to the law, and that way we can actually use these services that are cool and benefit from them without worrying all day long. Because to me, data protection is not really about taking the fun out of technical things, but making people trust in them so they can actually use it. And I'm always unhappy whenever I get emails of saying, oh, we discovered your case and know what you did, and now I locked off Facebook, because that's not really the solution in the end.
Mark Trimps kan faktisk godt lide sociale medier. Men som han siger, de sociale medier, det er jo os. Facebook er virkelig ikke andet end en blå topbjælke. Det, der sker nedenunder, det er noget, vi brugerne producerer. Facebook burde være i stand til at klare sig med reklamer, i stedet for at indgå i sære datamining-forsøg, som ingen kan gennemskue, og som Facebook ikke vil give indsigt i. Men hvad skal han så nu, unge Max, netop færdig med jurastudiet og i gang med at indskrive sig i europæisk datahistorie?
You just finished law school, so what's next?
We'll see. Right now the next thing is finishing my coke.
Thank you very much.
Max Trimps er altså nu uddannet jurist og klar på flere colaer, og du kan følge hans kamp mod Facebook på det website, han har lavet. Europe versus Facebook hedder det. Whistlebloweren Edward Snowden har hængt NSA og CIA og hele USA til tørre i de internationale medier. Men før ham, der var der andre NSA-afhoppere, der forsøgte at fortælle, hvad det var, der foregik inden for de tykke mure, uden at blive hørt, fordi det simpelthen virker for fantastisk og for underligt, hvis man ikke har konkrete NSA-stemplede dokumenter bag. National Security Agency er jo i gang med at udvide med et nyt datacenter i Bluffdale, Utah, og det kan angiveligt rumme hele verdens kommunikation på nettet og alle vores telefonsamtaler de næste 100 år frem. Men selve det system, som der skal bruges til at gøre den her slags ting, det blev sat i gang allerede i 2001, lige efter terrorangrebet den 11. september. Det fortæller altså den tidligere NSA-kodebryder William Binney. Mød ham her.
After 9/11, they took one of the programs I had done, or the back end part of it, and started to use it to spy on everybody in this country. So that was a program they created called Stellar Wind. That was the separate and compartmented from the regular activity that was ongoing, because it was doing domestic spying. All the equipment was coming in, I knew something was happening, but then when the contractors I had hired came and told me what they were doing, it was clear where all the hardware was going and what they were using it to do. It was simply a different input. Instead of being foreign, it was domestic input.
William Binney arbejdede for den amerikanske efterretningstjeneste NSA i 30 år som programmør og stod for store systemer, der blandt andet aflyttede Sovjetunionen. Men efter 11. september arbejdede han på et stort projekt, der blev kaldt Stellar Wind, stjernevinden. Men det nye var, at Stellar Wind ikke skulle spionere mod Sovjetunionen. Det skulle aflytte amerikanere.
The purpose is to monitor, be able to monitor what people are doing. You build social networks for everybody. That then turns into the graph, and then you index all that data to that graph, which means you can pull out a community. That gives you an outline of the life of everybody in the community. And if you carry it over time from 2001 up, you have that 10 years worth of their life that you could lay out in a timeline that involves anybody in the country. Even senators and House of Representatives, all of them. The dangers here are that we fall into something like a totalitarian state like East Germany.
Egentlig må man slet ikke aflytte sit eget folk i USA. Det er imod forfatningen. Men efter 9/11 blev man mere kreativ, hævder Binney. Det hed så nu, at så længe man bare samlede oplysninger på folk, så var det jo ikke aflytning. Ikke før man begyndte manuelt at undersøge data. Binney siger, at NSA, National Security Agency, har bygget et system, hvor man laver et slags socialt netværk, en Facebook på alle borgere i landet. Man laver en timeline på alle, en timeline af alle telefonsamtaler, alle e-mails og al anden kommunikation. Det har man ifølge ham gjort siden 2001, som en del af 11. septembers terrorangst.
It needs to be out in the open. We need to, as a democracy, we need to say, do we want our government doing this or not? And do we want our government to have this data or not? And if so, if we want them to have it, then what kind of controls? And they have to be a little bit more visible. It can't all be done in secret. You can't have secret interpretations of laws and run them in secret, not tell anybody. We can't make up kill lists and not tell anybody what the criteria is for being in the kill list.
Interviewet med William Binney er lavet af filmskaberen Laura Poitras, der arbejder med en trilogi af dokumentarfilm om Amerika efter 9/11. Det er hun ikke blevet populær på. Hver gang hun er rejst ud af USA og vender tilbage, så bliver hun tilbageholdt og afhørt i lufthavnen. Det er sket 40 gange nu. Flere gange har agenterne fortalt hende, at hun lige så godt kan fortælle alt. De ved det hele i forvejen, også fra alt, hvad hun laver elektronisk. William Binney selv har haft besøg af FBI. De kom forbi med trukne pistoler, mens han var i bad. De sagde, at han satte navngivende menneskers liv i fare. Han sagde, at det var dem, der overtrådte forfatningen. De gik igen. Han er aldrig blevet anklaget for noget. Til gengæld retter han nu anklager mod CIA og NSA og deres chefer for at have skabt et monster af et system. Et system, som Stasi, KGB og Gestapo ville have elsket.
This is something the KGB, the Stasi or the Gestapo would have loved to have had about their populations. So, I mean, you know, and just because we call ourselves a democracy, right, doesn't mean we will stay that way. That's the real danger. And we, the people, may have absolutely nothing to say about it. We haven't had anything to say so far.
Og det var altså ex-NSA-manden William Binney, der fortalte om Stellar Wind og om, hvordan NSA samler data om os alle sammen. Social graphs, der minder en del om Facebook.
We choose the right format. We leak the information to the public. And we defend ourselves against inevitable legal and political attacks.
Alt det her med sikkerhed og overvågning, det bekymrer faktisk ikke os danskere ret meget. Ifølge en undersøgelse fra YouGov, som ganske vist er en af dem, der er lavet på internettet, men ifølge den, der mener 46% af os, at det er helt fint, at efterretningstjenesterne gemmer oplysninger om os, også dem fra de sociale netværk. Men måske skulle vi tænke os lidt bedre om, for det kan også ramme os. Det fik den danske programmør Michael Kremer at føle, da han skulle rejse ind i USA på en ganske almindelig ferie.
Jamen, det starter med de helt simple spørgsmål. Hvor meget vejer du, hvor store fødder har du, og så videre. Sådan lidt absurde spørgsmål, men det er vel bare sådan lidt tjek. Og så går det så over, at det er lidt mere sådan terrorpræget, man kan sige det sådan. Altså, hvad synes man om 9-11 og angrebet mod USA? Og der svarer man selvfølgelig, at det er jo forfærdeligt, og man tænker ind i sig selv, hvorfor bliver jeg stillet det spørgsmål? Så skal man forklare de sidste 10 års rejseaktiviteter, og det kan være lidt svært for nogen. Og man er også lidt i en presset situation, men jeg prøver så godt, jeg kan på at huske, hvor jeg har været henne. Og så glemmer jeg faktisk at sige Rom forrige år. Og det fortæller så den her person, som så bliver meget sur og fortæller mig, at hvis jeg bliver ved med at lyve, så kommer jeg til at sidde her ganske længe, og det var bare en simpel forglemmelse. Og da jeg ligesom ikke nævner nogen navne, som måske er fjendtlige mod USA, jamen så begynder de at spørge ind til specifikke lande som Yemen, Nordkorea, Pakistan, der, som man har været der. Og der kan man jo bare svare nej.
Ja, altså, hvordan føltes det her, mens du troede, du var på turisttur, og nu sidder du lige pludselig bespurgt noget om Yemen?
Jamen altså, det føles jo som en amerikansk film, altså, eller en situation, man ikke burde være i, men som kun sker for andre. Så jeg tror egentlig ikke, jeg var sådan dybt chokeret. Jeg svarede bare, fordi jeg jo gerne ville på ferie, og jeg tænkte, det er nok det smarteste at svare så godt man nu kan. Men efterfølgende er det jo selvfølgelig absurd, at man bliver stillet nogle spørgsmål, som for en jo virker enormt absurde.
De nøjes ikke med at stille spørgsmål, de registrerer det også.
Ja, altså, der går jo ret mange timer, og jeg kommer også til at sidde sådan lidt for mig selv. Men det ender jo sådan set med, at vi, både min kæreste og jeg, bliver ført ind i et andet lokale med fem af de her officers, og får taget de her fingeraftryk på gammeldags manér. Og eftersom jeg ikke var så god til det, jeg har ikke prøvet det før, så blev der taget sådan ret hårdt fat, og ens hånd blev sådan ført, og de brokkede sig lidt over, at man ikke var så god til det. Men altså, fingeraftryk med blæk, simpelthen. Meget ubehageligt.
Så du står i, hvad skal man sige, et amerikansk register med fingeraftryk over det og det hele?
Altså, nu vil det ikke fortælle mig, om jeg står i noget som helst, men med al sandsynlighed er det nok det, der er sket. Også min kæreste, som jo ikke udgør noget problem udenbart.
De vil også have din telefon?
Ja, de beder om koden til ens iPhone, og så tjekker de selvfølgelig alt det igennem, der nu måtte være. Det spøjse er lidt, at under afhøringen ligger min iPad foran mig. Den kigger de ikke på. Der kunne jo også godt være noget, hvis det var, at der var mistanke om noget terror, så kunne det være oplagt at kigge på den også.
Ganske kort nogle måneder senere efter det her, den her ubehagelige oplevelse, der bliver du så, ført ud derfra i virkeligheden efter det, og ender med, at jeg kan ikke komme ind i USA.
Ja, vi kommer aldrig på sommerferie, nej.
Og det var altså Michael Kremer, der senere har fået lov til at rejse ind i USA igen, efter et langvarigt pres fra medierne og måske fra Udenrigsministeriet. Til gengæld så har han aldrig fået noget at vide om, hvorfor han ikke kunne komme ind i USA. Det var nemlig hemmeligt. Og det her med ikke at kunne få noget at vide om, hvad der er galt, når man står ved grænsen, det er han ikke alene om. Det gælder faktisk også nogle gange amerikanske statsborgere. En af dem, det er filmmageren Laura Poitras, som faktisk stod bag interviewet med William Binney, det vi hørte før. Men det er også hende, der har filmet Edward Snowdens nu verdensberømte interview fra Hongkong, det han lavede før han tog afsted mod nye destinationer. Laura Poitras er i gang med at lave en film om overvågning i USA, og siden hun begyndte med den her kontroversielle ting, så har hun haft store problemer med at krydse grænsen ind i USA igen, efter hun havde været ude at rejse i udlandet. Jeg spurgte hende om, hvad hun troede, der var gået galt for Michael Kremer.
So tell me, what's his biography? I mean, so is it racial profiling? I mean, or is it, what can you tell me about him?
Laura Poitras har et par ekstra spørgsmål om Michael. Er han hvid? muslim? Nå ikke, ja, så lyder det underligt, siger hun. Måske har det så noget med WikiLeaks at gøre, foreslår hun.
He's a programmer, so it's a computer. That's really interesting. So he's a, and has he been involved with like anything relating to WikiLeaks or anything like that?
Når aflyttet har ringet til Laura Poitras, er det fordi hun er ekspert i forhold til det at blive stoppet ved den amerikanske grænse. Som kritisk dokumentarfilminstruktør med speciale i 9/11 og Irak-krigen er hun nemlig udsat for særlig opmærksomhed fra myndighedernes side. Det begyndte i 2006, efter at hun havde udgivet filmen My Country, My Country, der handlede om, hvordan irakere blev behandlet af amerikanere under krigen der.
But you know, my situation is, you know, I'm on lists. So the government won't say what list I'm on because the government doesn't acknowledge it has lists. But I've done a FOIA, and I know that I'm on at least an NCIC list, which is a FBI crime list. And that came through in the FOIA, said that I was a match for that list, and then the rest of the document was redacted. So I'm on that list plus whatever was redacted. And I was put on the list. I mean, I started getting detained in 2006 after I made a film, a documentary about the war in Iraq. And yeah, I've been detained more times than I can count, I think upwards of 40, and have had my computer seized and my phones, and I've had my notebooks photocopied. I mean, you know, pretty aggressive stuff. I was threatened for being, they threatened to handcuff me on a recent trip for taking notes at the border because they said they threatened to handcuff me, which I think means they threatened to arrest me. I'm not quite sure what the law is at the airport, but I think usually if you're being handcuffed, then you're under arrest. And so they said that my pen, as I was taking notes of the agents and their names, they said that my pen was a weapon, that it was dangerous.
Selvom Laura er indfødt amerikaner, begyndte hun at blive tilbageholdt i lufthavnen, når hun kom tilbage fra udlandet. I starten slog hun det hen, og havde endda en vis forståelse for de agenter, der udspurgte hun i timevis om Al-Qaida og terror og hvad hun synes om det. Men så begyndte agenterne at konfiskere hendes udstyr. De tog hendes computer og kamera og konfiskerede hendes notesbøger. Det tog 40 dage, før hun fik dem igen. Alt indhold var blevet kopieret. En ting var, at det skete et par gange, men det blev ved. Laura Poitras anslår, at hun er blevet afhørt og tilbageholdt og har fået sit udstyr tilbageholdt godt 40 gange siden 2006. Nu er det efterhånden blevet rutine. Til at begynde med var hun ofte venlig og imødekommende over for agenterne, i det håb, at det så ville tage kortere tid. Nu er hun blevet mere aggressiv, siger hun. Når hun bliver taget til side og tilbageholdt, insisterer hun på at få agenternes navne og høre, med hvilken ret de tilbageholder hende. Hun har også indtil for nylig insisteret på at tage noter under afhøringerne, men det kan hun ikke længere. Sidst hun blev tilbageholdt, fik hun nemlig besked på at holde op med det, ellers ville agenterne lægge hende i håndjern. Da hun spurgte hvorfor, fik hun det svar, at hendes kuglepen jo kunne bruges som et våben.
Several people told me that my note-taking was the fact that I had a pen, it was a sharp object and I could use it against all the people around me that all are carrying guns. You know, it's pretty absurd. And, you know, in my case, it's a little different in the sense that, I mean, I don't justify what the U.S. government's doing, but, I mean, I've been documenting sort of post-9/11 America. And so, in a way, at first when it started happening, I thought I was kind of naive. I thought, oh, well, this is a mistake and it will change. And now I'm like, oh, it's actually entirely consistent, you know, that they're targeting me because I'm trying to talk about what the U.S. is doing post 9/11. And it's very consistent to target the people who are, you know, maybe trying to dig deeper. And so, you know, right now we have like a very aggressive prosecution of whistleblowers going on in the States.
Laura Poitras kommende film handler om overvågning. I den har hun blandt andet talt med en tidligere ansat i NSA, der fortæller, hvordan NSA overvåger og registrerer alle telefonsamtaler, alle e-mails og kontooverførsler over hele verden. Oplysningerne gemmes for senere analyse. Det er ikke nyt. Man har gjort det mod udlandet siden 80'erne, men efter 9/11 vendte man også systemet mod amerikanerne selv. Den tidligere NSA-agent William Binney valgte at være whistleblower omkring den her omfattende overvågning. Det fik konsekvenser. Han har blandt andet haft besøg af FBI med trukne pistoler.
Right. I can give you a little bit of background on Binney. So Binney was, you know, he's a brilliant mathematician, crypto analyst who was working at the highest level in the NSA and was in charge of nuclear threat detection under the Cold War. So this was the guy that we trusted to understand if there was, you know, a threat of nuclear war from the Soviet Union. So this is a guy who was working at the highest level and was also a genius in terms of graphing and mapping of data and data analysis. And so he developed this software that was, you know, dealt with, you know, graphing and building profiles of people based on metadata being, you know, not necessarily the content of information, but the relationships. So this person phones this person. We're not necessarily targeting the conversation, we're targeting the relationship. And then from that, we build graphs. And in those graphs, we understand who people are, what they're thinking, da, da, da. And so this is what he did. I mean, that was his job. And so he left the NSA after 9/11 because what he'd created was being turned against the United States after 9/11. So they basically abandoned the Fourth Amendment in terms of person's right to privacy and etc. So it's real. I mean, like, you know, so for those who think it's paranoid fantasy, like, this is a guy, not only was he working at the highest level of the NSA, he actually built the stuff. So he actually knows what it can do. Because he designed it to focus on international. I mean, that's what the NSA is chartered to do, is to spy on the rest of the world. But not to spy on Americans. I mean, that was kind of what was carved out in terms of the mandate of the NSA. And I think after 9/11, that sort of separation was abolished.
Men hvordan kan det være, at en pæn dansker uden skummel fortid er havnet på en amerikansk no-fly-liste? Ifølge Laura Poitras kan det skyldes flere ting. Han kan dele navn med en person, som USA ser som en trussel, men det kan også være simpel inkompetence. USA har nemlig privatiseret store dele af deres sikkerhedsapparat til private firmaer, og samarbejdet mellem dem er legendarisk dårligt. Lauras råd til Michael er simple. Husk at tage noter, få deres navne og bliv ved med at klage.
I mean, luckily, I mean, he's from a European country and he's white. And I hate to say that, but you know, it puts you in a position of maybe trying to fight this kind of stuff, or you're perceived and different kind of a way. Like, I wouldn't be, I mean, you know, the work I do is possible because I hold a U.S. passport otherwise, you know, because it gives me, you know, kinds of protection, right? You know, I mean, I think you should fight it for sure and try to make it. And it would be great to actually find out what, you know, like, have somebody with intelligence clearance just, like, figure out, like, what the fuck, you know? How can this just happen to someone? They're not charged with anything. And they can treat you, you know, if you are, you know, a criminal and you don't have any idea why.
Og Laura Poitras seneste film om blandt andet William Binney og Edward Snowden, den er altså stadigvæk ved at blive klippet færdig. Aflyttet følger sagen. Her til sidst skal vi en tur op i skyerne, eller rettere sagt ind i det, der hedder cloud computing, sammen med en tidligere privacy-chef i Microsoft. Han hedder Kasper Bauden, og han mener ikke, at cloud computing er, hvad det giver sig ud for at være. Det er simpelthen at forære sine data væk til CIA og NSA, mener han. Hør hvorfor her.
My name is Kasper Bauden, and at the moment I'm an independent advocate for privacy and human rights. And formerly I was chief privacy advisor to Microsoft in 40 countries for 9 years. And before that I started up a British think tank for internet policy called the Foundation for Information Policy Research.
Kasper Bauden ligner lige præcis det, han er. En midaldrende tidligere forretningsmand, der engang har arbejdet for Microsoft. Faktisk har Kasper Bauden arbejdet 9 år som Chief Privacy Advisor for Microsoft i Europa. Bauden er ekspert i databeskyttelse, EU og USA's love om overvågning. Han har været rådgiver for det engelske parlament om privatliv og databeskyttelse, og før det har han arbejdet med kryptografi og programmering i finanssektoren, benannet for Goldman Sachs. Kasper Bauden er kort sagt ikke hvem som helst, men det budskab, han rejser verden rundt med nu, har skaffet ham ikke så lidt mistro, modvind og modstand. Han mener nemlig, at vi befinder os i en verden af masseovervågning fra firmaer og regeringer, der er ved at komme ud af kontrol. Jeg foreslår ham ordet overvågning, men det mener han ikke er dækkende.
Well, in fact, I prefer not to use the word snooping. I prefer to use the word mass surveillance, which in this case is not an exaggeration. The word snooping is almost sort of friendly. It sort of connotes maybe something that isn't too harmful. How I first got to learn about it was actually when I was still working for Microsoft, and I was specializing in developing the strategy for making cloud computing lawful in Europe. And I won't go into the full details of that, but 18 months ago I left Microsoft, and I'm prepared to say publicly that I'm not happy with what the position of legality was in Microsoft when I left. But I'm not going to say more about it. What I've tried to do since then is read a great deal more into American national security law and put together almost a jigsaw puzzle, which has not, strangely, been reported by the European press so far.
Bowdens hovedopgave hos Microsoft var at finde en måde, deres datasky kunne fungere under europæisk lov. Flere og flere firmaer bruger i dag skyen til såkaldt cloud computing, store privatejede serverparker til at gemme data på i stedet for på lokale maskiner. De mest kendte skyer tilhører i dag Google, hvor du kan gemme dine dokumenter, og andre spillere på den bane, det er Apple, Amazon, IBM og Microsoft, der blandt andet har lagt SkyDrive ned på alle nye mobiler med Windows Mobile. Med SkyDrive kan du gemme dine billeder, din e-mail og dine dokumenter sikkert i deres sky, siger de. Men ifølge Kasper Bauden er skyerne hos de store amerikanske firmaer bestemt ikke sikre. De er nemlig underlagt amerikansk lov, og den gælder ikke for EU.
So, a few years ago, after 9/11, there was a big scandal in America over something called warrantless wiretapping. And through some whistleblowers, some working for telecommunication companies, some working for the super secret National Security Agency, leaked to the press that the mass surveillance apparatus of the National Security Agency, roomfuls of supercomputers tapping the transatlantic fiber optic cables, had actually been turned on the American people. And this was in, clearly as part of the counter-terrorist effort, but the whistleblowers strongly felt that this had exceeded both presidential, constitutional and statutory power. So, as a result of the public scandal, in 2007 and 2008, some laws were passed to make legal what formerly had been illegal, but the practices still continued. And the strange thing is that these laws were quite expressly written to be aimed at gathering and analyzing data about the people of the rest of the world. They were expressly designed not to target Americans. But because of the spillover effect, Americans were nevertheless, and I think justifiably, concerned about the level of increased surveillance this would have meant in America domestically. But the strange thing is that no European media in particular sort of put two and two together and asked the question, well, what do these laws mean for us? Because a lot of European data is going into cloud computing. A lot of European data is going through American switching centers on the internet. And these laws say in black and white, they're quite complicated, but it's very clearly spelled out, that this gives the American government the right to spy on us politically. And this is the concern that I've tried to talk about at this conference. When data protection authorities, the regulators who look after the privacy of our information in Europe, when they talk about these questions, they have a certain bureaucratic language where they talk about requests for data, law enforcement access. And what I was trying to point out is the scope of these requests is in fact much larger. It also covers the use of this data for purely pursuit of American foreign policy interests. And in fact, this could mean people, for example, in the CIA, learning things about the private lives of European politicians, of activists, or people just engaging in ordinary democratic activity, and using this to interfere with our political process. And this is fully lawful in America, under American law.
I 2008 indførte USA en ny lov, FISA, Foreign Intelligence and Surveillance Act. Formålet med den var at retrolegalisere den massive dataaflytning uden dommerkendelse, som NSA og CIA i praksis har udført lige siden 9/11 i 2001. FISA er lige blevet forlænget til 2017, og i USA har der været en del debat om omfanget af overvågning af amerikanere. Men det er faktisk os, europæerne, der burde være bekymrede, siger Bowden. Med FISA er det nemlig helt lovligt at udføre masseovervågning af ikke-amerikanske statsborgere uden for USA. I praksis betyder loven, at USA's efterretningsvæsener kan udstede en hemmelig overvågningsordre til et amerikansk firma i EU og bede dem om at overdrage alle deres data om europæere og europæiske firmaer til dem. FISA gør det således muligt for USA at spionere direkte på os alle sammen. Politikere, aktivister og helt almindelige menneskers data og mails kan gemmes, analyseres og bruges imod os, hvis det passer USA. Sidste år fik EU-kommissionen en rapport i hånden, der handlede om netop det, men Bowden konstaterer, at der har været meget, meget stille omkring den rapport. Alt for stille, synes han. Gennem 18 måneder har han forsøgt at komme i kontakt med EU-toppen for at bede dem gøre noget ved det, men ingen ønsker at lytte, og derfor har han nu bestemt sig til at gå til offentligheden med sin viden. Og den viden er ikke rar. Hans historie begynder faktisk allerede i 2003, og siden da er overvågningen accelereret.
So what we do know is that around 2003 and possibly earlier, around 2003 or earlier, in the major telecommunications switching centers, in particular one was discovered in San Francisco, the National Security Agency put in what's called a deep packet inspection box, and they used equipment to split the signal on the main fiber optic cable of the western seaboard of the United States, carrying both domestic and international traffic. They fed this into this deep packet inspection box for analysis, and then some part of that traffic, presumably the part concerned mostly with international communications, was then relayed back to the headquarters of the National Security Agency. And the documentation that emerged in that case strongly suggests that this was done in a dozen or more sites, not just one site. And so, if you like, this was a permanent installation for capturing and filtering foreign traffic entering the US on the internet. However, in the law in 2008, which I mentioned, the so-called FISAR Act, Section 1881A, it in fact had a feature that nobody noticed at the time, which was the definition of a provider was changed to include cloud computing. And the significance of this change is that a lot of people think on the internet that they are protected by encryption. When they see that little padlock symbol in the browser, they think that their data is protected between them and, well, where? Well, the data is only protected between your browser and the website or the data center of the company concerned. And if that's an American company, then there is, since 2008, the possibility that one of these boxes has been installed inside the data center. And so, of course, encryption is going to provide no protection at all.
I 2003 installerer NSA, National Security Agency, deres første netsplitter hos AT&T, telefon- og internetselskabet. Splitteren deler nettet op i to, så NSA får en kopi, om man så må sige, af alt, hvad der foregår på hele nettet, direkte ind i deres computer til aflytning og analyse. Men det var kun første trin. Systemet dækker nu hele internettet, og i al stilhed er der begyndt at ske noget andet. Den lov, som NSA har brugt til at foretage aflytning via nettet, kom nemlig også til at omfatte cloud computing, alt hvad der foregår i skyen. Når man bruger en sky til data, tror man automatisk, at de her data er beskyttede, ikke mindst hvis der er kryptering i ens service. Problemet er bare, at den kryptering kun gælder fra afsenderen og til filen kommer ind i skyen. Her bliver den afkrypteret igen. Hvad nu, siger Bowden, hvis USA har installeret ikke en hemmelig aflytningsboks, men et program i samtlige skyer fra amerikanske firmaer? Et program, der scanner, analyserer og gemmer data fra brugere af skyen og sender det videre til efterretningstjenesterne.
Yes, I think first thing to mention is that it's been widely reported that the National Security Agency is building an enormous new data center in Utah, a place called Bluffdale, which is due for completion sometime this year. And the capacity, processing power, the power supply actually being built for this new data center makes it one of the biggest of its kind ever built. So one has to ask the question, what is this for? Is it in fact to examine the rest of the world's data, or is it to examine Americans' data? Now, as I've mentioned, Americans are very worried about these developments, and I sympathize with them. But I think it's the rest of the world that has more reason to worry. I think it's also naive to believe that the use of these surveillance capabilities will only be for anti-terrorism purposes or for anti-criminal purposes.
Men hvorfor er der ikke nogen i EU, der gør noget? Jo, forklarer Bowden. Der er masser af sikkerhed omkring klassificerede dokumenter fra regeringer og EU, men næsten ingen for privatpersoner og organisationer. Det virker underligt, siger han, og antyder, at det er noget, der er sket med vilje, at staterne frivilligt har overladt borgernes liv til USA. Men hvorfor skulle de gøre det?
The general position that most governments seem to be taking around Europe is they have data which is classified for national security purposes at various levels. Some is a little bit classified, some is highly classified. But then there's a much broader amount of data which is processed about people's lives for e-government purposes. And of course a lot of commercial data about people, which is still quite sensitive about their private life. And unfortunately, most governments seem to be saying that it's okay to send this data to the United States. For a mixture of reasons, I think that there has almost been a deception campaign going on for years, which I saw starting with my time in Microsoft, to try and give false reassurance to European governments, to say there's nothing to worry about, move along, there's nothing to see here. But the fact is, when one looks into the history of diplomacy and the history of espionage, it's always been the case that allied countries have spied on each other. They even have a special classification for it. It's called NOFORN, no foreign eyes. And it's naive to believe that intelligence agencies would not or could not exploit this data to interfere in the political processes of another country. It's what intelligence agencies do. That's what their job is.
So they're doing it because they can?
Of course. And frankly, what has been very interesting about the public reaction since this story started to break a couple of weeks ago on an American blog is there have been a few blog reactions on America which have basically said, almost unanimously, oh, so it seems we can spy on Europeans. Who cares? Who's going to stop us? Whereas the reaction in Europe, particularly on Twitter, has been, I think, of course, outrage. I think people do find it outrageous that another country is being given, more or less with the knowledge of our regulators and our institutions, the ability to spy on our citizens politically. It is outrageous, and it's something people should try and put a stop to.
Kasper Bowdens historie er foruroligende og mystisk. Han er godt klar over, at mange vil anse ham for en paranoid, overuddannet europæer, der bare trænger til en fin sølvpapirshat. Men hvor sikker er han på det, han siger?
How strong is your evidence or personal feeling that this is actually going on?
It's a good question. Am I saying that this is a theoretical legal possibility, or am I saying that this is something that was actually could have been done, was done in 2008 or in the past few years? I'd have to give it about a 50-50 probability. Looking up all the evidence I've considered and using my network of contacts in privacy and security, of course, I've been asking myself that question. And I can't give you a definite answer, but my guess, best guess, is it's 50-50 likely it's already been done. But if it isn't already been done, it will almost certainly be done in the next few years, unless we put a stop to it.
D. Det var altså, hvad jeg havde valgt at bringe det her sommerremix aflyttet. Jeg vender tilbage igen i næste uge med mere nyt fra vores allesammens globale overvågningssamfund, hvor du ser på mig, og jeg ser på dig, men helst gennem et kamera eller en skærm, men aldrig lige i øjnene. Call connected through the NSA. Complete transmission through the NSA. Suspending your rights for the duration of the permanent.